Hello, I'm Kate Jabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the SITREP podcast from BFBS. Amid all the warnings that we could be at war with Russia within years, it seems hard to remember that not that long ago, for a brief while at least, we were getting on okay. After the Cold War thawed through the 90s and 2000s, cooperation evolved in space, science, and even a little between militaries. Rose Gottemuller had a ringside seat as a key US and NATO official to see the evolution and then breakdown of these relationships. She's drawn on these experiences for her new book, rejecting what she calls spin from President Putin about US and NATO intent and how it's been used to justify his war against Ukraine.
Well, first of all, I became rather impatient at some of the propaganda lines coming out of the Kremlin, which were that Bill Clinton was dead set on enlarging NATO to the borders of Russia and posing an existential threat to Russia. That's not the Bill Clinton I remembered when I was working in the White House in 1993 and 1994. He actually, from the very beginning, was dead set on forming a stable security, economic, and political relationship with the Russian Federation. Recently, you know, the Soviet Union had broken apart, and Russia and the other newly independent states were really feeling their way. And Clinton was convinced that unless we had a stable and healthy relationship with Russia, there could be no security or stability in Eurasia overall. Peace would not reign in Eurasia. And so from the very beginning, he wanted that relationship with Russia and with his Russian counterpart, Boris Yeltsin.
And that starting point for your case, the cooperation efforts by President Bush Sr., then Bill Clinton, you worked on one of the main key mechanisms for that, the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission. Can you just tell us a bit more about it?
Yes, it was actually quite an innovation at the time. The notion that these two Cold War adversaries who had been essentially competing and racing for the past 40 years through the space race and beyond, also with nuclear weapons, that suddenly their two governments would come together, the departments of the United States government, the ministries in Moscow, and would become deeply entwined, working together on major, at the time, high technology cooperation, like establishing cooperation for manned spaceflight. This was unprecedented, and it really was a turn away from the enmity of the Cold War and quite revolutionary. But I think that both Clinton and Yeltsin chose the right men to head up this effort. Vice President Gore was a masterful politician, but also a very, very good administrator and manager, somebody who could command respect across the government. And it turned out it was the same for Viktor Chernomyrdin. He came out of the dust pile left after the demise of the Soviet Union, not only with some personal fortune from his management of Gazprom, the big Russian gas company, but also, I think, based upon his wide experience as a Soviet apparatchik, as a Soviet technocrat and bureaucrat. He was very skilled at pulling strings in Moscow.
And what was it like working on that commission? What was the mood like between the countries at that point?
There was a great deal of positivity. There was this feeling that we were in a new age and that, you know, there was a lot of talk afterwards that somehow the United States had won the Cold War and we'd defeated the USSR. But the mood for both George H.W. Bush and for Bill Clinton, there were two strands of feeling. I think one was the notion that we could take a peace dividend now and our former enemy could become a partner, and a partner that would be of use to us. There would be a mutual utility in this relationship. But also, secondly, there was a grave concern about the fate of the former Soviet nuclear weapons complex. There was concern with the country flying apart, the USSR flying apart, nuclear weapons left on the territory of Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus would form the kernel of some independent nuclear power. We can talk about that if you like. But the main issue inside the Russian Federation was whether these warheads and whether the nuclear material that could make more warheads would fall into the wrong hands, would fall into the hands of terrorists or state actors who would be trying to build their own nuclear weapons program. So there was this urgent concern about securing Soviet-era nuclear weapons and nuclear material.
And what actually stands out in your memory from being part of that process? There must have been some very surprising days.
Well, there were certainly some very tough negotiators still very much part of the Russian Federation government at that time. Yeltsin himself had grave political problems. There was the so-called Red-Brown Alliance with some of the former communists, well, still communists. The Communist Party is still alive today in the Russian Federation, but also more nationalist forces that were beginning to battle it out for political power in Moscow. So he had a very unruly parliament to deal with. So there was a lot of almost anarchy, I would say, in dealing with Moscow. But at the same time, there was this undercurrent of stability from a long-running Soviet governance system that continued to be able to perform some important tasks. So there was partially a chaotic situation, but then partially just this resolve to get things done and to basically save the remnants of the Soviet economy from total destruction. And so I think that fueled interest on the Russian side in continuing the cooperation. And then in the end of the day, what was so remarkable was the similarity between the scientists and the military people on both sides. They'd been on either side of this divide during the Cold War, but in the end of the day, they were working on very similar projects, very similar organizational structures. I do remember some of the pilots who became astronauts said how, when they were talking to their counterpart, Russian pilots who had become cosmonauts, how much they enjoyed exchanging reminiscences about how they'd been patrolling against each other on either sides of these Cold War borders during that period. But it was a kind of positive reminiscence about both sides being ready to defend their patch and do it in a very professional way. So there was this professionalism on both sides that I think really also fueled the cooperation.
And the crux of Vladimir Putin's argument for many years is that the US Secretary of State, James Baker, informally assured President Gorbachev that NATO would not expand an inch eastwards. But then in 1999, he says it did. Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic joined. How was that received in Moscow at the time?
Yes, it's very interesting. There is that single sentence from Baker that keeps getting referred to time and time again by Russian leadership. But we must remember that the documents that actually lay out the Russia-NATO cooperation are documents that were agreed by both Moscow and NATO, by the NATO capitals. And they are the NATO-Russia Founding Act of 1997 that Boris Yeltsin agreed to, very important foundational document for NATO-Russia cooperation, I will stress. And furthermore, then in Rome in 2002 at a NATO summit, Vladimir Putin himself signed the Rome Declaration with George W. Bush and the other NATO leaders. And that launched not only the NATO-Russia Council, which was an organizational structure for cooperation between NATO and Russia, but also 15 years of very pragmatic project work between NATO and Russia on some very sensitive matters, such as what would we do if a nuclear weapon went missing somehow in Europe? Would the two countries or would the two entities, Russia and NATO, be able to work together to recover a lost warhead? Very sensitive project work. And they worked together because there was a great deal of concern at the time, even as there is today, about nuclear terrorism. And so the notion that we'd have to work together urgently to recover a lost warhead was an urgent project. But these were sensitive and important projects, and NATO and Russia were cooperating deeply during the first decade of this century.
But when that actually happened in 1999, how was it received at the time?
Well, I remember that there was grumbling, of course, and some concern remaining, but it wasn't as if Russia threw itself in the way of a train barreling down the tracks. At the time, there were not major concerns raised about the NATO enlargement issue. Frankly, at the time, the greater concerns were revolving around the wars in the former Yugoslavia, and at the time in 1999, the bombing of Belgrade by NATO aircraft, and that was a very grave, I would say, political shock in Moscow. At the time, there was supposed to be a meeting of the Vice Presidential Commission, but at that time, the Prime Minister, Mr. Primakov, was actually in the air on his way from Moscow to meet with Vice President Gore, and he turned his plane around and flew back to Moscow. So that was a very dramatic moment, but that was related to the wars in the former Yugoslavia. It wasn't related to NATO enlargement.
And you've already mentioned that in the first Putin years, cooperation continued, and you were working in Moscow in the mid-2000s. What was your experience of the move towards the US and NATO at that point?
It's interesting because at the time there was actually a NATO representative in Moscow. Her name is Isabel Francois. She still works at NATO headquarters in Brussels. She was running a NATO office, and there was wide-ranging cooperation. I would say wide-ranging from the NATO perspective because, for example, Isabel Francois organized a major public relations trip for the then Secretary General of NATO to travel all the way across Russia and talk about NATO and various capitals. So there was a lot of effort going on to reach out a hand to Russia at the time. But the stresses and strains were already starting to emerge at that time. And I do recollect that there were some criticisms of NATO beginning to emerge. I even took part in a conference of NATO parliamentarians in Sochi during this period. And I remember thinking at the time that it was suspicious, but some protesters were gathered outside the hotel. And even chatting to them on local TV stations, the Georgian TV station was finding out that they had been paid to go and stand and protest outside the hotel. But at that point, it began to be clear to me that there were some tensions over the NATO cooperation. And I, of course, hoped innocently, I guess, that the tensions would not worsen. But in fact, in the mid 2005 to 2008 period, while I was in Moscow, it was clear that the relationship was already starting to go bad between NATO and Russia.
And how did that feel personally to you at the time, sensing that?
I think, again, having lived through the 1990s and the warm and intense cooperation, and don't forget the cooperation was still going on in that first decade of this century. We had a lot of very, very intense cooperation to secure Russian warheads and fissile material, nuclear material. Those projects continued through that decade. And so I could see that the good results were being created on the ground in Russia. Furthermore, our cooperation on the International Space Station was very strong at that time, and I could see that the two organizations, NASA and Roscosmos, were continuing to work in a very deeply entwined and successful way. So I guess perhaps I was overly hopeful that somehow the reality of the cooperation and the benefits to Russia would countermand any tensions, any stresses and strains emerging on the political front, but I turned out to be wrong.
And was there a point at which you started to feel unwelcome yourself in Moscow?
No, by no means. In fact, quite the opposite. And this is a bit of a funny story because I became the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center in late 2005. In January of 2006, I moved to Moscow. And the very first day, it was a Sunday, so the evening TV show called Vesti was coming on, and I flipped it on, and there was the Carnegie Moscow Center shown in the screen, and it said above, Carnegie Moscow Center, nest of spies. And so I thought, oh, great. Welcome to Moscow. And indeed, it was very tough. We had, in my first months in office, we had several bomb threats with, you know, the bomb squads coming in with their dogs to examine whether we had a bomb in the offices. We had death threats against some of my researchers, which really concerned me a lot. It's interesting, the Russians are rather fatalistic, so the researchers didn't seem to be so worried. But I was greatly worried, and luckily our ambassador at the time, William Burns, a very experienced diplomat, I think was able to get that quieted down, luckily. But the most long-running situation was a tax investigation, which was the usual practice at that time to hassle institutions to send in the tax investigators. And they stayed with us for a good long time, over a year, and they kept looking for something wrong with our books, but they couldn't find it. I had a very, very professional accounting team, and they were getting frustrated by that. Suddenly, one day then, in the spring, I got a call from my main CFO, my chief of financial operations. She said, a miracle has occurred. They called off the tax investigation. The investigators have left the offices. And it was the very day that Dmitry Medvedev was named as president of the Russian Federation. You may recollect that Putin changed places with Dmitry Medvedev there for a couple of years between 2000 2008 and 2011. And it was a miracle indeed. But at that point, things lightened up for me at the Carnegie Moscow Center. And in fact, we got, I would say, more done in terms of positive cooperation between the center and different entities in Moscow. And that was an ephemeral moment, as it turned out. But when Medvedev came in, he had this reputation of being a reformer. He had an iPhone. He wanted to go to Silicon Valley and learn about what we were doing with our innovation economy. There were all these signs that somehow he was going to be more reform-minded than Vladimir Putin. And this was essentially the message for President Obama when he came into office in 2009, that his counterpart in the Kremlin was a reform-minded president.
So when do you see as the marker in time when effectively the NATO-Russia cooperation came to an end?
I really take it down to the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014, because up until that point, and I remember myself, I was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and we had a number of continuing projects going on with NATO, including trying to get Russia to help in the removal of chemical weapons from Syria, which was a project that NATO countries participated in. And Russia at the time was thinking about it, was back and forth with a lot of discussion. But in the end of the day, they did not participate. That was 2013. And so it was only in 2014, I would say, when the invasion of Crimea occurred and the destabilization of the Donbass, that the relationship came crashing down in a way that was quite remarkable. NATO declared no more business as usual with the Russian Federation and shut down all of the projects that we had going on. I think, you know, quite rightly, there was a good reason to do so. But it's interesting that some cooperation did remain. When I arrived at NATO as the Deputy Secretary General in 2016, there was still a Russian mission to NATO and a Russian ambassador to NATO. And so there was NATO-Russia cooperation continuing in the NATO-Russia Council even practically until I left NATO in 2019.
So some cooperation still existing, but could we or should we have done anything differently to make that cooperation more widespread and more meaningful?
I think we did well, especially in the pragmatic project work that I've been talking about. Things I talked about, the counterterrorism, nuclear counterterrorism work, but other things such as preventing the trafficking of narcotics out of Afghanistan. That was a project that was very strong, and it prevented opium from and heroin from flowing into the Russian Federation, but also prevented it from flowing onto Europe. So it was quite a useful project overall. I think that that practical work was to a great advantage. But I think at the upper political level and in the context of the NATO-Russia Council, indeed, it quickly became the NATO allies versus Russia. And there was not this notion of somehow trying to work with Russia and come to consensus with Russia. It was frequently the case that the NATO allies would come to consensus and present the Russians with a fait accompli. And the Russians didn't like that. They wanted something more approximating partnership. Perhaps it wasn't possible, but I do think, looking back, I think if we had somehow turned the NATO-Russia Council into more of a cooperative organization, then it might have worked a little bit better. That said, the Russians themselves are tough, as I know from being at the negotiating table with them. They're tough dudes. They're tough guys to deal with. And coming to agreement with them is sometimes simply impossible. And you tend to throw up your hands and say, well, if you don't want to try to work in a positive way on this, forget about it. So I think that always there is some of that in working with the Russians. They're very tough negotiators, very difficult to deal with. And sometimes they don't want to come to consensus for political reasons, even though it may do them good to reach agreement.
It's interesting that you say that they are tough to deal with. I'm curious to know how you actually coped yourself.
Well, it helps that I've lived and worked in Russia. I know Russian. I've spent my career working on Russia and the USSR before it. So I think I have a well of patience that comes from a better understanding of how the Russians operate, but also ability to work with them on more of a equal interest basis, that they seem to appreciate that. And I appreciate it certainly when they are willing to reach out to me and make concessions on particular issues. But these are, you know, from the smallest issues, when we were working on, for example, these projects to build better fences around their nuclear facilities. Sometimes they were the smallest issues, such as ensuring that we could get equipment in to lay the fences and that type of thing, up to these major issues I've worked on, such as negotiating the New START treaty. As in any negotiation, you have to look for areas of mutual interest and then try to work it so they recognize those interests on the other side of the table. It isn't always easy, once again, but a lot of experience helps.
So I suppose the question is, how do we return to a cooperative relationship with Russia, and is it even possible?
Yes, that's a major question I wrestle with in the book. And I have to say, in the end of the day, I came to the conclusion that over the long run, it will be better for NATO, for the United States, for NATO partners to come to some modus vivendi for cooperation with the Russian Federation, because the alternative is to try to wall them off and defend against them permanently. And I don't see that being a stable situation for the long-distance future. I'm back to the very point of Bill Clinton's conviction back in the 1990s that in order to have security, stability, and peace in Eurasia, there needs to be some kind of pragmatic, solid relationship in security, economics, and politics with Moscow. That said, I'm also very clear in the book that until there is a fair outcome for Ukraine, until this terrible war of Russian aggression against Ukraine is resolved in a way that is fair to Ukraine, number one, and I say in the book, it's likely Vladimir Putin is going to have to be departed from the scene. And I'm making no predictions about how he departs from the scene, whether he is gone from this earth or whether he leaves power and retires to his palace in Sochi. I think he will have to be gone from the government of the Russian Federation, the leadership of the Russian Federation, in order to make cooperation happen, because his personal conviction is so wrapped around the notion of enmity with the NATO countries and the NATO institution that I think it won't be possible to develop cooperation while he remains in the Kremlin.
It's a mine of information and knowledge. The book is called Security Through Cooperation. Rose Gottemoeller, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great having you on SITREP.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Defense Explained. This is SITREP.